Hi, I'm Ben McAdams. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center. I'm joined by Shireen Gourbani on the left and Ryan Wilcox on the right.
Ben, we're so happy to have you.
Thank you. I appreciate you inviting me back from time to time.
Good to see you, Ben.
You too. Look, let's just dive right in. We were talking before the show and about some of the big issues. Big news out this week from the Biden administration, who's taking an executive action as it relates to immigration, right? Shireen, yeah. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I'll say, as a person on the left who has been frustrated with many of the things, honestly, that the Biden administration has been doing around immigration, in particular, significantly reducing the number of individuals who can seek asylum at our border, this is welcome news. And so what this news is folks who are married to U.S. citizens who have been in the country for 10 years, and there's a whole list of things that they can't have done, right? So if you were deported and then came back into the country, you won't be eligible for this program. But basically what it's saying is they think there are about 500,000 people who fall into this category who are undocumented individuals living here who are married to U.S. citizens. And those individuals will now be eligible for what is called parolee status, or basically what they can do now is live without the constant fear of deportation. And it does provide a pathway eventually for people to apply for permanent residence, or I think also citizenship is part of what could be eligible here. This is wonderful. And what came to mind for me immediately, it actually kind of makes me emotional, but when I was knocking on doors running for Congress the same year you got elected, so 2018, I spoke to a woman in Bangda, knocked on her door, asked for a vote. We ended the conversation afterwards. She came out after and said, look, here's what's going on with me and my family, and I want to know where you would come down on this issue. This is something that's happening all across this country. It's happening right here in Salt Lake County. It's certainly happening in Utah. This is an act of kindness. This is an act that I think is fundamentally something that we should be proud of. But I can imagine that others have different opinions, or maybe others commentary to add to it.
Well, for me, this reminded me, similar experience, but this goes way back. But in 2009, 2010, I was involved with a group of people who were writing the Utah Compact. And we were having intimate, private discussions about what this should look like. And there was a scenario, I'm probably not going to remember the specifics, but there was a family in Bountiful where the mother was a U.S. citizen. The father was an undocumented immigrant, and he was picked up in an ICE sting and deported to Mexico, leaving the mother and, you know, four or five kids home without a father as he was deported to Mexico. And so I remember this being really compelling to a lot of people, seeing this family torn apart. Yeah. And so there's a line in the Utah Compact about immigration, we should have sensible immigration reform that keeps families together. And was really motivated by this family's experience in Bountiful and really personalize it. People seeing how the harm that's done to kids and to families. So, I really see this action as pro-family, keeping the family unit together, keeping married spouses together to raise kids. And I think it is a big and a bold step forward. Mm-hmm. It's not without, some commentary about the dysfunction in Washington.
Yep.
I'm sure that as this plays out, we'll hear the complaints about this being an executive action. It really should happen by Congress, and they're right. But Congress is failing to step up and failing to act. And so I do see the president stepping forward to protect families and to keep the family unit together is a good step forward.
Honestly, it strikes me more of a little bit of a schizophrenic response. I'm going to agree here with Shireen in that...
Exciting.
It's a little bit different perspective, right? But I'm going to agree with her in the sense that this is a little bit of whiplash, right? We've had... this asylum policy, we heard about that a lot this week in the Subcommittee on Organized Crime. The first half of the meeting was about that. Congresswoman Malloy came and testified about what she's seen on the federal side. We had some of our county sheriffs, and I went down to the border at different points to try to understand why this was happening. What we heard over and over again was really the opposite of this asylum policy interpretation from what Shireen mentioned earlier. And really, that was the driver. It was that policy change. And so what we see is sort of a response in a campaign year that he's losing on that particular issue. He throttles it back, and then he responds with, meaning the president responds with this new change this week, which almost feels like he's throwing a bone to one side, which frankly is sort of a reasonable bone. If somebody's got a family here, we don't want to create
chaos
home with a single parent family and all the disadvantages that come there and the lack of support that that family needs now. At the same time, we are losing. I had another conversation last week with someone here in Utah who's both immigrants, by the way, who have come here the right way, as we say, applied through the visa process, waited years from overseas, came here, earned their degrees. We've educated them in our universities, top tier at one of our firms here in Utah, and their visas have expired, and they now have to go home and start over. And the company wants them here. They're wonderful contributors to our community. There isn't a path for them right now. They're not famous enough. They're not whatever to get the things creased. And instead, we're forcing them back. So we have people that have done it the right way that we're punishing. And we have another incentive, so to speak, for folks who sort of snuck across the border or paid a cartel or however they got here.
It is. I mean, I've been to the border also when I was in Congress, and it is completely broken. And the dereliction of duty from the federal government, and I think it is bipartisan. We certainly saw the Democrats and Republicans in the Senate work together on a bipartisan immigration reform bill that had consensus. And then President Trump decided that it would be better to have a political issue rather than fix something that's putting the country and our kids at risk, rather to have a campaign issue than to do what's right for the country. That was really disappointing to me. But I will say, like, you know, on one hand, we are talking about keeping families together. On the other hand, there are scary things at the border. Border security is a real issue, and Democrats can't deny that. But we have drugs and weapons coming across the border, human trafficking, really scary things that are coming across the border that we need to take seriously.
They have landed here in Utah, which is why it gets brought to us on the Hill.
That's right.
Right.
You know, I always say, I think we need to put a padlock on the back door and a doorbell on the front door, and let's fix the system. But that's not what's happening right now. I think you're seeing people saying they'd rather have the political issue and a club to beat somebody with than to do what's right for the country, and very disappointing.
So speaking of things that are broken, let's talk about the Supreme Court.
Yes.
So we have some big decisions, more pending, that we'll probably hear in the coming days. But at the time of recording, the two biggest cases that really caught my attention certainly was really, I would say, kind of just kicking the Mifepristone case right out and saying this is so. For listeners, to remind you, abortion is legal to 18 weeks in Utah. This ruling does not have an impact on that. But more broadly, if you're in a state that has access to legal abortion, what the Supreme Court here said was that a medication that's commonly used in about 2/3 of all abortions that take place in the U.S., it remains legal and available under the current rules. And they kicked this right out and said that the folks who brought this case did not have standing. So I thought that was a pretty interesting decision, a unanimous decision. What were your thoughts on that?
I think it's rare that it's unanimous like that in such a controversial topic that gets brought before the court. And when it is, it means that they were sure that they didn't have standing.
I think as the lawyer, it's worth noting that standing is not a ruling on the merits, right? So it does mean that somebody else can bring this back. So, yeah, we have such a political Supreme Court that you have to wonder if this isn't just an effort to push it past the election and give the court another chance, another bite at the apple.
Yeah, I hope not, especially considering that Mifepristone is incredibly safe. It's about 99.7% safe, much safer than things like penicillin or Viagra, for example. We also had a ruling on bump stocks. Do you want to, anyone want to explain this? Ben, you want to give it a go?
Well, if you remember, this is after the Nevada Las Vegas shooting, right? And it's an executive action by President Trump to ban the sale of bump stocks. And the Supreme Court, in a 6-3 ruling, has said that essentially that this is an unfair restriction on the right to bear arms.
Yeah. So, I mean, I remember that 2017, right?
Yeah.
I believe 58 people were killed, over 900 were injured in this shooting. And I just had to kind of pull some numbers to like really understand what we're talking about. Bump stocks, when applied to semi-automatic rifles, can increase the speed, the rapidity of the basically 800 bullets a minute can come out of a semi-automatic that is modified with a bump stock. There is good reason, I think, to understand that this starts to look like a machine gun, right, to people. Machine guns are outlawed. Ryan, what are you thinking about this?
I think this one was entirely predictable, right? You know, we saw a note here, Clarence Thomas noted that they were relying on the single function of the trigger definition, which I would have expected to come from conservative justices. So this came down, I think, like we expected it to come down.
This is something that's worth noting, too, that Congress can take action, right? Yeah. This is not a ruling on the Second Amendment itself, but if Congress wanted to come in and take a ruling on this and to prohibit this, they could.
Well, the justices are referring back to precedent in previous cases, which is why we all expected this to come down this way.
So I'll just highlight in Sotomayor's dissent, she said this decision will have deadly consequences, and I think we can expect that in this country.
Well, if President Trump's elected, I look forward to him coming back to tackle this issue and pushing legislation through the Congress.
Well, that was one of my favorite parts of this whole thing, right? Is it was his rule.
Yeah.
And then he supposedly supported, I heard a statement that he supported the repeal or the loss at the Supreme Court. I don't know.
Talking about whiplash and schizophrenia.
Yeah.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm with Shireen Gourbani and Ryan Wilcox. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shireen Gourbani on the left.
Ryan Wilcox on the right.
And I'm Ben McAdams in the political middle. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. So let's jump in. We had a warning from the Surgeon General come out this week, right? Reminiscent of warnings that are warning labels on cigarettes and, you know, but calling for social media apps to include mental health warnings, stating that their apps can cause significant mental health harms for adolescents. You know, as a parent of four teenagers, absolutely. I could not be more passionate about endorsing this. I think that it is harmful to our kids. And, my kids are mild to moderate users of social media. And I have real concerns about the impacts of social media. We've seen them behave in ways that to promote addiction and they're, sure. I don't know. What do we think about it?
Yeah, I like this idea. I wonder what it looks like in practice, right? I wonder if there, like, is it specific posts that would come with this warning? I know there was a deep expose investigation around Instagram targeting specifically women around content related to body image, really around dieting and weight loss. And I think it'd be interesting to know, is it going to be around specific content? Would it just be in general? I'm kind of in favor of in general. I have a little dude, 9 years old, and I'm trying to keep him off of this as long as I can. But Ryan, where are you at?
Has it worked? To the extent that any of the warnings that the Surgeon General issues are effective at all, yeah, this clearly qualifies, right? This is, I'm curious about implementation. What does that look like? Did it work when we first did it with cigarettes?
It did. The data shows there was a significant reduction.
Just from the warning?
Well, so that's hard to know because many other programs were happening at the same time, right? Increased funding for smoking cessation and other things. So maybe if you think about additional education or outreach that may be happening, if states or schools are funding that, thinking about a warning, like there are multiple things that could be happening that would potentially contribute to improved outcomes.
To the extent that it communicates to parents what we didn't know when my 21-year-old was entering his, cell phone phase, whatever, with social media. Yeah, I wish I'd have had more information.
Yeah. So I think this is connected to some of our local races, specifically in our debate for the Republican debate for the attorney general. Derek Brown's lobbying for Meta and campaign fundraising focus really came up. So there was
Utah's really let out, right, on this anti-social media litigation and the state of Utah bringing litigation.
Yeah.
Right?
So do we want our attorney general to be a person who was on the payroll of Meta was kind of the question. He said in the debate, or my understanding is in a follow-up potentially, said that, you know, that's not a client he has currently. But I guess what when you think about, well, I've numerous times said it's time for us to maybe consider not a Republican in this seat, considering the controversy that Republicans have had over many recent terms. But I don't know, Ben, what are you thinking when you...
Well, I first have to say, I think probably all of us know Derek Brown on a personal level. He's a very affable person. I worked really closely with him when we were both in the state legislature together many, many years ago. And, you know, I found that there was a lot that we could agree on. But I will say, this is not a commentary by any means on Derek Brown, but I will say after the levels of corruption that we've seen in our attorney general's office over and over again, with Sean Reyes now leading under a cloud of suspicion, following on John Swallow, following on Mark Shurtleff, and clouds and allegations of impropriety there, to now be turning to a lobbyist to put in the place of our attorney general gives me some concern. Not aimed at Derrick Brown in particular, but I am concerned about a lobbyist. And I'd like to highlight, you know, another candidate, which is Michelle Quist. So her platform has really, she's running as an independent, I think, / United Utah candidate for AG, really is a single issue candidate. And she's saying that the attorney general's office should be nonpartisan.
Yeah.
You remember how we used to have like state school board, you would run not as a Republican or a Democrat, but you're just running for the state school board. But to give a degree of independence, so this isn't a partisan person looking to run as a Republican or a Democrat to do the bidding of a political party, but running to just represent the interests of the people of Utah on a nonpartisan basis. And I found that a really compelling platform. And kudos to Michelle for, I think, and bringing the attention to that.
So I'm sure you have feelings about this race. You want to weigh in a little bit or?
Yeah, well, I understand the political strategy of trying to you know, tag Derrick Brown with all of this
built-up
angst about social media. And, you know, I understand why his opponents would do that in any of these scenarios. That said, I was part of a lot of those conversations. I was in the room with a lot of those conversations. And Derrick, to be fair, as a lobbyist, he's an effective lobbyist. Derrick did a great job of protecting Utahns. Remember, he's also a father here with kids here, has a little bit of a different interest with that. And frankly, as I think about somebody who I would want to be in that office on this side, I have exactly the opposite view. Derrick knows that playbook better than anybody else of what they're going to use because he was hired as their attorney. We can choose to hire him as our attorney now. That would be a smart move if you like to understand how to best combat those who have this other perspective. You know, he hasn't been a lobbyist for a long time on that one. He hasn't been lobbying for anybody for, you know,
not since December, I think, is what
whatever.
I
remember. Yeah, many months.
Yeah, since last session.
Yes.
Right? So, yeah. He's.
Well, while we're talking about politics, I think there were some other big political news this week with Donald Trump weighing in to endorse Celeste Malloy for her re-election for Congress. And this sets up an interesting dynamic where you have Mike Lee, really a stalwart of the MAGA movement, who went in to support Jason Walton in the U.S. Senate race, where Donald Trump then later endorsed Trent Staggs. Now Mike Lee going in heavy against Celeste Malloy to endorse Colby Jenkins. And now Trump coming in to support Celeste Malloy.
Yeah.
How do you feel today if you're Mike Lee?
Well, my favorite thing that Mike Lee's ever said is when he sent the text just saying, just tell me what to do. But apparently he's no longer interested in Trump just telling him what to do and is happy to do his own thing when it comes to endorsing candidates. I guess what this says to me is that we have a host of fairly extremist Republican candidates. But I'm sure, Ryan, you've got a different opinion on that.
You know,
what do you think about endorsements
generally? I don't
know
Jason Walton. Okay, yeah, that's probably the question. I think the more that they're used, the less value they hold, right?
I think that's right about endorsements. I think, you know, as when I was, when people knew who I was, you know, people would always want my endorsement. And I just don't know that endorsements carry that much weight to begin with.
I mean, it can in a certain race at a given time, especially with an unknown candidate. But that's not what we have anymore in Celeste Malloy, right?
Yeah.
Those of us that have worked in politics have known her for like 15 years. And we know her as a competent staffer and sort of a brilliant strategist. And, you know, she's smart. We never would have imagined that she would have been the one that would ever run. But she also got thrown into this because her boss had to leave at the last minute because Chris Stewart had to bail. And so Celeste, I think she's done a good job for the most part. And that's what people are going to make their decisions on. She has extremely tight relationships throughout her district in rural Utah. And, you know, she worked in Washington County. She lived down there and she's been all over that district. So I think that's what people are going to base this on. I think it does help her, you know, counter some of that pressure from the other side when the president, the former president endorses her for this. So congratulations to her on securing that one to the extent that it nullifies any of the other pressure.
Yeah.
I overlapped with Celeste a little bit when I was in Congress and always found her to be an incredible professional, brilliant woman. You know, been happy to see her success. And, you know, it's not my party and I don't want to hurt her by saying too much complimentary about her. But, you know, I think she's been a refreshing, really a workhorse who's just about getting down to business. And you know, I was actually disappointed with the Trump endorsement when I saw that come through. But
it's a political thing right now, right?
Yeah.
I had totally understand why her campaign would have sought that endorsement right now.
So let's continue this conversation about some of Mike Lee's forays into the public sphere.
Yeah.
Waterboarding.
So what Mike Lee did, it based Mike Lee's Twitter, kind of other alt account, in a poll, he asked his followers, if you had to be locked in a room basically for a day and listen to NPR, KSL radio, or be waterboarded, what would you choose? Overwhelmingly chose waterboarding. Now, I find this irritating because, first of all, I don't think water, hate to be a wet blanket on this one, but waterboarding really isn't a joke. Like, I don't love that we're like making light of that. It is a form of torture, and I'm really deeply disappointed that it was a tactic that was commonly used by our government, by our military. But aside from that, I'm wondering, like, is Mike Lee mad at like KSL News? Like, what is going on? What's the backdrop on this? Is there some infighting that we're not following closely, Ryan?
Yeah, it's more than infighting, and this is something that I think, you know, he's obviously had frustrations with, and Republican Party in general. This is not, you know, this came from a post that KSL Radio made on the internet the other day, wherein they openly disparage the Republican Party as a whole.
Okay.
News organizations are supposed to be, you know, we're here clearly. I love that about this show, by the way. Shireen on the left, Ryan on the right, right?
Yeah.
We intentionally have these conversations. Our news organizations, we trust, generally we want to trust that they are unbiased news sources. That's not always the case. When they cross the line to when they're saying, isn't the Republican Party ridiculous on their official communications?
Yeah.
Aren't you sick of these ridiculous people? You know, I understand when Republican office holders will say, hey.
Frustration.
You know, this is way over the line. And so, and I also have some insight into the conversations with the chairman of the Republican Party, with Rob Axton. So he went to KSL, and they had the conversation, and they thought there was retraction coming, and it wasn't.
Yeah.
Right? So that's where that came from.
Well, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I thought that the post did come down, and there was a statement, but maybe I missed that.
It was a statement.
Okay.
A statement.
But not the,
we're
not
sorry
that
you were
feel,
offended
okay.
kind of
okay,
statement.
Yeah.
We'll do better
yeah.
next time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm pretty sure I'm about to be offended or certainly irritated because we do have a special session. So right now is interim, but a special session was called by our governor to block Title IX protections for transgender students in a special. So basically what happened is the Department of Education released rules ahead of the new school year, so to go into effect on August 1st, that would allow transgender students to use the bathrooms or locker rooms that align with their gender identity. Now, this is directly in conflict with the new state law that is requiring people to use the bathrooms and locker rooms in government facilities that correspond with their gender at birth. Utah in the last session passed the Utah Congressional Sovereignty Act, which is absolutely like, so bonkers to me. It makes me want to scream. But so now we have a special session. And again, I just have to remind people, called by our governor, who in large part came to national prominence around a speech lifting up and valuing the lives of queer people who were killed at the Pulse nightclub shooting. Now he's calling into session a special session so that we can further target trans students. So my frustration's deep. I feel like I don't want to throw it to you, Ryan, to have to defend this. But Ben, any commentary?
Fine.
Okay, go ahead. Let us hear why this is a great use of our tax dollar.
Oh, well, that's one of my favorite parts of this, is that we're already meeting, right? I hear that all the time about we're call special sessions to be super expensive. It costs us $0 more because we're doing on interim day. We're already there. We're already being paid the same rate. It's like the $200 or whatever it is that we make a day.
It's kind of a technical distinction, right?
Yeah. Like, we just call it a special session, but that's we're already there. We're just going to meet and vote on a few bills, and it's obviously not just that bill. But to that point, yeah, you have a federal partner-ish that acts more like a king, then yeah, the state is going to have an opinion on that, especially when it runs exactly contrary to the policy that was just passed.
Yeah. Looking forward to the state revoking freedoms on a day where we celebrate freedom. Ben, anything else?
Well, I think it's worth diving in, and maybe Shireen, you can talk us through this, but the state will say they are reacting to Title IX changes that
the
are coming into effect.
The redefinition of Title IX, the whole thing was about males and females, right? When the federal government comes in and says that, no, males, who we all understood what that meant until 10 minutes ago, all of a sudden have a completely different definition. We're going to apply that in schools and reinterpret it. There's a reason why they came out with the rule to reinterpret it.
Yeah.
Because that's popular now, especially with the Democratic Party.
But you could also imagine a world in which we understand things differently than we understood them at one time. And I hope that what we're moving towards in this state and in this country is greater acceptance and awareness and trying to find ways that we can keep people safe, but also honor their dignity and create safe spaces for all.
That's
but,
why
and
the
I would
bill.
I guess I would just say that, you know, anytime we're dealing with kids, we should be sensitive and thoughtful. And in this case, we're dealing with some of society's most vulnerable children. And I just don't know that for either side, election year politics are the way to address this. So, you know, we'll see where it goes. And Representative Wilcox, thank you for representing us at the legislature.
Sure.
And we understand.
I mean, not me exactly,
you know.
But yeah. Thanks for being there.
But that this is Both Sides of the Aisle. We thank you for making time to be down here. You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Ben McAdams. I've been joined by Shireen Gourbani and Ryan Wilcox. And thank you to our producer, Anthony Scoma. Thank you for listening.